I felt a strong sense of solidarity with my comrades, and I could think of my own death without too much flinching, as a soothing veil that would fall slowly over me and all my terrors of the past, present, and future. My head seemed to be filled with a milky fog, which was without joy, but which suddenly made everything easy. Did my comrades feel the same way? I couldn't be sure, but my resignation seemed general. We rolled on for several hours at a reduced speed. Finally we stopped and walked through the gray, foggy morning to a camp of wooden huts, whose appearance recalled the robust military organization only recently lost. We were given an hour to rest, and the chance of a cup of hot water with a few grains of soya in it. And to think that some fellows volunteered for the food, somebody muttered. There couldn't be too many volunteering these days, another voice said. Very few are around for long enough even to dream of becoming an officer. There's hardly the time to make obadge fritter, before they're getting a posthumous stripe. A few were still around for a little longer than that. Then a major, who was probably the camp commander, spoke to us. Proud soldiers of the Gross Deutschland, he said. Your arrival in this sector fills us with joy. We know your reputation for courage in combat, which gives us a strong sense of support. Your comrades in arms in the infantry regiments fighting in the Polish forests near our frontiers feel as we do. Your arrival here reassures and comforts us, and also helps us in the extremely difficult task which has fallen on us. The defense of German and European liberty against the Bolsheviks, who would take it from us, employing the most extreme and bestial means. Today, more than ever before, our unity in combat must be total and deliberate. With the addition of your strength, we shall build a definitive rampart against the Soviet horde. Think of yourselves as the trailblazers of the European Revolution, and feel proud that you have been chosen for this undertaking, however heavy it may be. I wish the greatest possible glory for you, and convey to you the congratulations of the Führer and of the High Command. Transportation and food have been specially placed at your disposal to help you in achieving your aims. Bravo, soldiers, and courage. I know that so long as a single German soldier remains alive, no Bolshevik will ever tread on German soil. Heil Hitler! We gaped at the elegant officer in stunned silence, trying to penetrate the veil of ignorance which hid our valor from us. Heil Hitler! Shouted Affeld, who realized that the prescribed response to the major's remarks had not occurred. Heil Hitler! We shouted heroically. Either I'm crazy, Kellerman muttered, or he was expecting us to raise his morale. SSHT, said Prinz. We're getting another speech. This time, it was a Hauptmann. It will be my privilege, he said, to take 2/3 of the men in your regiment under my command, and lead them into battle. We all had known what was waiting for us, but that phrase made us swallow hard. The entire division will be operating in a sector to the north of us. It will be broken up into several fragments so that a series of widely scattered attacks can be made against the Russian thrust, which is extremely strong in this sector. I am expecting from you the utmost in courage and actions of distinction and glory. These are essential because we must stop the Russians here. No negligence or hesitation will be allowed. Three officers can constitute a court-martial at any time, and sanction any penalty. Poor Frosch. How many officers decided to hang you? We shall be victorious here, or be covered with shame. No Bolshevik must ever, I repeat, ever, set foot on German soil. And now, my friends, I have some good news for you. There is mail for some of you, and citations, and promotions. But, before giving free rein to your joy, you must present yourselves at the store for fresh rations and ammunition. Dismiss. Heil Hitler. We broke ranks without any clear idea of our situation. Things are looking up, I said. A bastard who'd be glad to see us all killed, muttered Hals. We were standing in a long line in front of a large wooden building. So that's what we get instead of Wesridow. Something tells me we'll be having a few eye-openers, Prinz. Impossible. We've already seen everything there is to see. He's another one of these madmen, said Hals. He's not. "He's perfectly right," said another voice behind us. We turned around in surprise. "He's right. It has to be here, or not at all. I can't explain why without taking too long. But he's right." More and more disconcerted, we stared at Uemo without saying a word, unable to grasp his attitude, which suddenly seemed so changed. "I'll tell you why some other time," Weena said. "For now, you're too thick to get it. Paula, as I write, I'm looking at the letter I've longed for so much, and as I read your lines, I forget the icy ground, and the east, which is still so filled with menace. Your letter, which is in my hand, seems like a miracle from heaven. I don't expect anything more from the ordinary world, from which we seem entirely cut off. I read your lines as our comrade Smelens, who is lucky enough to believe in God, recites his prayers. Nothing can help us anymore, Paula. Prayers seem like vodka, they blunt the cold for a moment. Happiness has become entirely relative, and can mean simply daybreak, because darkness makes us think of death. I have been promoted to Oberfritter, and although the stripes are still in my left pocket, I already feel that much more important. I think these extraordinary and difficult moments have made us into men. I can hear a roar in the east, Paula, but maybe it's only the wind. I look forward so much to reading another letter. For several days now, we had been fighting again as we retreated. The Bolsheviks must never set foot on German soil. However, three powerful Soviet armies had already crossed the German frontier at 5 or 6 points, penetrating to a depth of some 30 miles. These three armies had rolled over our defending troops, whose survivors were dragging with them through the autumn countryside the last weapons which supported their claim to be part of an army. To my regret, I am unable to retrace in detail the chaos of those bitter moments. But I can outline the ends of my friends, like Prinz, Sperlovsky, and Solma, and of Lenson, who, in spite of everything, was really a friend. And it is Lenson I wish to salute now, by describing the tragedy of his death, which I can still see clearly, through the memories of so many other deaths. Whatever Lenson may have thought of me at times, I am certain that for all of us, and for his country, he was a brave man, who would have sacrificed his life without hesitation to help the most insignificant fellow soldier. The manner of his death fully supports this view of him, and it is perhaps because of him that I am sitting here now, writing these lines. Lenson could never have accepted life as it is lived today, with all the concessions the former troops of the Eastern Front are obliged to make. Like the order for which he died, he was irreversible. Men who have embraced one idea can live only by and for that idea. Beyond it, they have nothing but their memories. Our attempt to save the Courland Front failed, and the overpowering Russian thrust reached the Baltic at several points, which I can no longer locate with any precision. The northern front was cut into the far north, around the Bay of Riga, as far as Libau, and the sector to which we were sent, a continuously shrinking front to the west of Libau, in Prussia and Lithuania, clinging farther south to the Vistula, which was the scene of hideous carnage. The division was split into several small groups which attempted to throw the enemy off balance by attacking simultaneously at many points. For the most part, these attacks were unsuccessful, and were hastily transformed into defensive actions. At that time, the division was precipitately attempting to regroup, in order to establish a defensive front some 40 miles to the northwest. The bad roads, lack of fuel, mud, and faltering communications combined to slow down an operation which, under good conditions, wouldn't have lost us any time. In addition to our other difficulties, we had to contend with enemy aircraft, which had become increasingly active. Each overflight spread fresh disorder through our already weakened columns. When the order to regroup came through, our officers decided that the retreat should be spread out, and divided into small groups. This idea made sense in that we offered less of a target to planes. However, when an enemy armored unit ran into 2 or 3 widely dispersed companies, our chances of survival were at best problematical. It was under these conditions, in a village of scattered houses, that an encounter took place which almost erased our group from the divisional list. "I'm sure I've been here before," said Lenson, who was shocked by the misery of the country. "Everything looks so different now that I don't recognize any details, but I'm sure that over that way there are some villages I know. My own village is about 60 miles from here," he gestured toward the southwest. "Königsburg is over that way. I've been there several times, and once I went to Kranz, too. It was raining cats and dogs, but we went swimming anyway." He laughed, and we listened. Despite the crushing retreat and numbing cold, Lenson seemed to have revived on his native soil. But he felt the anguished silence of this village, whose inhabitants had fled the day before, more intensely than the rest of us. 300 of us, exhausted by a march, which had begun at dawn, off 12 miles over waterlogged ground, were sitting doubled up for warmth, waiting for an uncertain 11 o'clock distribution of food. Only Lenson was on his feet, pacing up and down the length of the stable wall, which the rest of us were leaning against, sheltering from the incessant rain. We heard his voice against a background of explosions which were more or less loud, more or less distant, coming from the southeast. We scarcely noticed the sounds of war anymore. They had become so much the ordinary background of our lives that we no longer paid any attention to them unless they were inside a perimeter small enough to threaten immediate danger. Except for the noise to the east, everything was quiet. We were somewhat like people these days who cannot enjoy peace and quiet without a phonograph, who need noise before they can relax. Perhaps they are simply afraid of true silence. Unfortunately for us, we had no control over the volume of noise, and in fact would have been much happier without it. Except for Lenson's harangue, nothing was happening. Some 25 yards from us, six men were preparing lunch. Somewhat further off, another group were seriously engaged in attending to personal needs. Others were resting, with their eyes half closed, or staring into space, dizzy with exhaustion. The melancholy autumn weather brushed our faces with its damp freshness. We had been through so much misery that we were unable to appreciate conditions which ordinarily would have moved us to pity. Through our condition of near torpor, we were dimly aware of suffering and weeping. The wounded were groaning and dying. But none of that stopped anyone from sleeping whenever there was a chance. The first part of our meal had been passed out. Cellophane sausages stuffed with soybean puree, one for every two men. It goes without saying that these were cold. During the retreat, the men in charge of supply, with a stirring display of professional conscience, had collected enough old and wrinkled potatoes to fill a sidecar. They were just handing them round to the men when four soldiers jumped over a wall. They were gasping for breath, and as they ran toward us they made large, sweeping gestures with their arms. One of them called to us without shouting too loud, "Ivan." The sluggish mass of men stood up with a single movement. We knew that the next few minutes could face us with the most appalling danger. With the instinct of hunted beasts, we had already scattered, each man running to wherever he saw a possibility of the slightest protection. Those who were lucky enough to have already received their food wolfed it down hastily. Lieutenant Wallace had just joined us in a recess sheltered by a roof. His field radio, which he always kept near him, was already crackling out an alert. We waited in silence for about 10 minutes, but nothing happened. The Russians could not have been very far off, as our sentries had announced them. But none of us knew whether we would be dealing with a section or a squad, a regiment or 10 men. We hastily organized patrols. We had to find out whether we were going to fight or run as fast as we could. The six fellows nearest Wallace were sent over towards the wall our two sentries had jumped. I was among them. Two other groups of about the same size were sent in other directions. To describe my desperation and terror would be repetitive. It was the same as at Outcheny, Belgrade, the sheds where the partisans had hidden, and so on. Like everyone else, I was resigned to the bad moments of our existence, to the sinking feeling which comes with being ripped from sleep to meet some disagreeable obligation. This was like that, only more so. We moved along the other side of the stable against which we had been dozing a few moments before, and came out onto a rough piece of ground stacked with old timbers. We were fully aware of our danger, and a heavy sense of desperation, which no longer accelerated the beating of our hearts, made us alternately hate death and long for it. My Mauser weighed down my hands like an object of no value, on which I could no longer count for anything. Formerly, as we marched through Polish and Russian villages, its weight of wood and metal had given me such a sense of confidence that I had felt almost invulnerable. Today the possibility of organizing any kind of effective defense with these weapons seemed entirely unlikely. We crossed the waste ground and arrived at a cluster of buildings, where we separated into two groups of three men each, and continued to advance as carefully as if we were carrying explosives. We turned the corner of the building, and were able to see a much larger piece of the horizon, marked by a line of trees which had been almost entirely stripped of branches. Beyond the trees was a road, swarming with men. In the distance, we could see still more approaching. "There must be at least 300 or 400 of them," whispered the man next to me. "Look over there." We walked back past the building where we had been resting earlier. At its far end, a row of tar barrels stood out very black against the chalky soil. Beyond them was a small house. Our steps made a light crunching noise against the fine gravel. Still silent, we stepped into the space beyond the barrels. We took four steps and found ourselves face to face with four Russian soldiers on patrol, who were taking the same precautions and observing the same silence we were. For us, all process of thought froze. Our gestures were without haste. The Russians opposite us were also moving very slowly, and watching us. It seemed as if, by some miracle, the same calm had been imposed on both sides. No one fired. With deliberate, calculated movements, both Russians and Germans withdrew to the shelter of the building. We stared at each other with enormous eyes. "We've seen enough of them," muttered Wiener. "Half turn." We went back to our starting point, and Wiener made his report. We felt as if we'd been dreaming. A quarter of an hour later, we had set up our defenses in the northern part of the village and its approaches. According to our intelligence, we were involved with an infantry regiment of some 2,000 or 3,000 men. There were 300 of us, but we were not ordered to retreat. Hours of agonized waiting went by. We were used to lengthy Russian preparations, but we also knew how steady their thrust would be. By the time the first contacts occurred, it was already growing dark. The first Russian assault units moved carefully up to the buildings under cover of dusk. The waves of Russian infantry no longer had the same dash as at Belgorod or on the Dnieper. Such astounding losses had been inflicted on those howling dot mobs throughout the reconquest of their territory that the Russian high command had been obliged to conceive a somewhat less heroic tactic. Also, although they were fiercely determined to revenge themselves on us by trampling on German soil, they were fully expecting us to mount a desperate resistance, and they had come to count more heavily on the effectiveness of their tanks and aviation to reduce our smaller, under-equipped units. On our side, the magnificent lines of shouting soldiers were becoming increasingly rare, while the Bolsheviks were increasingly fighting in a European style, using techniques more or less learned from us. This shift did not make our position any easier. Our group fired at a Russian patrol leaping toward us, but we saved our mortar for later. We were beginning to run out of shells. This was only a small encounter, which seemed without importance to men accustomed to tornadoes of fire. A few fragments of brass hurtling through the dusk, breaking a shoulder, crushing a breastbone, or carrying off a life nothing, in short, which even approximated the pitch of a real battle. Of course, if the same exchange should take place in Paris today, it would be considered sufficiently serious to empty a whole section of the city, and make all the headlines. Each time has its own habits and style. Throughout that black and foggy night, the Russians continued to dig in beside our precarious positions. The thought that they might burst out at any minute was terrifying enough to make us sick. Perhaps this evening would be our last. Ivan would overrun us and put an end to this desperate chase which had lasted for nearly 2 years and covered thousands of miles marked with fear and blood. Probably tonight would be the night. We no longer knew what to hope for. But the night went by, a night of cold watchfulness broken by flares and distinguished by nothing in particular. The Russians, who seemed to be in no hurry, watched us, as we watched them. I even managed to sleep, despite the watch we were supposed to keep unbroken. Several others did the same, and it was only the cold that kept us from having a real rest. Finally, dawn broke, and with it our tension increased. The air and ground shook. The rain, which usually muffles noise, seemed to have no effect on the heavy grinding of chains and the percussive exhaust of a large number of armored vehicles. A column of tanks was driving toward the motionless village, where Russian infantry was already waiting, calm and resolute, for our deaths. We knew that there were not enough of us for any kind of defense against tanks. We had no anti-tank guns, and the few Panzerfausts we had left would never be able to stop that mass of tanks, which we judged from the noise to be quite large. Our hair bristled with cold and fear as we organized our disengagement with the speed that had become familiar. Everyone was on foot except for the drivers of our two sidecars, which were used for liaison between the command group and ourselves. 10 soldiers were harnessed to each gun, as we couldn't let the Russians hear the sound of engines. The company withdrew in a silence worthy of Hollywood Indians, leaving just enough men to form 3 interception groups. Each of these was made up of 10 men, with 2 Jagdpanzerfausts, and 4 covering riflemen. My group included Smelens and a young boy who had been specially trained in handling a Panzerfaust. Lindberg, 2 other fellows, and I covered them. This proved to be the only time I was ever in command, a unique and tragic time during which I was responsible for 5 other men. In the second group, I knew Lenson at the Panzerfaust. In the third group, no one. Each anti-tank group had 3 Panzerfausts heavy, cumbersome weapons which allowed us a total of 18 chances. With maximum luck, if we hit home every time, we could hope to stop 18 of the 60 to 80 tanks we knew were coming toward us. We stiffened with terror as we grasped the desperate reality of our situation. Lieutenant Wallace told us that the enemy was slowing down, and that when 5 or 6 of their tanks were in flames, their demoralization would increase. He said that we would rejoin the company within 24 hours. But nothing could distract us from the horrible mathematics of the situation. We knew too well that the implacable thrust of the war could not be stopped. Today, on this day accursed of all others, our turn would probably come. The rest of the company moved silently past us, as we listened to the final recommendations of our superior. The rumble of tanks continued unbroken. I saw Hals going by beside the veteran, and ran out to grasp his hand. Lieutenant Wallace stopped talking when he noticed me. I produced a few obscenities for Hals and Wiener, inappropriate to the gravity of the moment, and briefly considered giving Hals something to send to my family later. But I couldn't find anything, and limited myself to a hoarse laugh. Hals couldn't think of anything to say to me, and Wiener dragged him off. Wallace left us next, and our groups separated. I remained alone with my command, and with my doubtful friend, Lindberg, who had turned white and numb with fear. I, much too young for the job myself, had become a group leader, charged with dragging 5 other boys who had not yet attained their majorities into a horrible game of cops and robbers. I threw a quick glance at my subordinates. They were staring toward the south, where the noise was coming from. Lenson shouted, and waved toward a dip in the ground where there were 4 or 5 buildings, probably a farm. I and my group ran off to Lenson. The third group looked for somewhere to hide along the road. The wind was blowing in gusts, carrying the first half-formed flakes of the season. At that moment, the Russians began to pound the positions we had just left. The houses in the village about 1/2 mile away were surrounded by geysers of black earth. Hastily, I sent my 2 Jagdpanzers to a position among the large roots of some overturned trees. They began to dig frantically, trying to lower themselves a little deeper into the ground. The rest of us looked for shelter nearby. I was with a young fellow whose name I forget but whose expression of determined tenacity remains ineffaceable. Lindbergh and our sixth man ran into the house behind us. 100 yards to our left, I could see Lenson and his assistant. The Russians were pounding the village into the ground. It was lucky we had left it when we did. As we listened once again to the noise of tanks rolling through smoking ruins, we relived the sensation of waiting through the unbearably long minutes just before action begins. We tried hard to think, but the diabolic round of our past unwound through our memories good and bad moments in a rush too fast for any of the relief tenderness can bring. For me, there was a mixture of childhood, the war, and Paula and all the things I still had to do and should have done. The kind of debt which weighs on the heart, when time for settling has run out. We were all torn between wanting to weep and run away, and to scream and run out to meet the danger. No Bolshevik will ever tread on German soil. But they were there by thousands, crushing it with frenzy and jubilation, and there were 18 of us to stop them. 18 young men ready to cling to any miraculous superstition to go on hoping for a future as tormented as the present. Then they appeared, 10 of them at first, following the road guarded by our third group. The third group watched them coming and did their duty. We helped them, inspired by almost unbearable emotion, played out by thousandths of a second. The first tank was stopped some 20 yards from the two Panzerfausts in the third group. One of their projectiles burst on the tank's front apron, scattering a shower of rivets and killing the monster and its occupants. The others were slowly maneuvering, heavily attacking the incline of the bank, to make their way around the burning tank. I couldn't stop myself from whispering, "They're coming for us." But the tanks, three to be exact, climbed back to face up to the threat. They hoped to frighten the anti-tank crew, counting heavily on their terrifying appearance, a calculation which almost always worked. However, a second monster burst into flame. The tank behind it brushed past, opening up a passage. It reached the German position, and broke its occupant's nerve. We saw our comrades jump from their hole and run like madmen. They were trying to reach the woods, and began to climb the hill. The tank, which was following right behind them, drew so close it almost touched them, before knocking them to pieces with the machine guns on board. The rest of the defense suffered the same fate. In 3 or 4 minutes, the third group was knocked out. 10 or 12 tanks were roaring down the road the company had taken on foot an hour earlier. They were certainly too far for us to try to reach them with any prospect of success. 5 more tanks appeared, following the dip of the valley, driving straight at the farm and at Lenson, who was just in front of it. Lenson and his number 2 man fired at the tanks, which were about 20 yards from them. They hit 2, and the noise of the explosions flooded the valley with a wave of sound. A third tank passed the 2 wrecks and seemed to be heading directly for my group. Lenson's group fired a third time, missing the tank and nearly killing us. A building some 5 yards from our hole burst into flame. The explosion half buried us, and made us totally deaf for nearly a minute. The 3 tanks continued, pouring fire into the farm buildings. They must have thought our defense was centered there. 2 more T-34s which had just appeared on the road left it, driving at Lenson's position. They were out of our range, but we fired at them anyway. Smellens fired at a tank some 150 yards away and just missed it. The shell touched the ground, bounced off it, and landed farther off without exploding. All we had done was to draw their attention to us. One of the tanks drove straight at us, using all its guns. I could hear the shouts of my men. They were unable to fix their sights on the huge machine, which drove at the ruins of the house and skidded over them, probably in the belief that they were crushing us beneath their tracks. I could hear the grinding from my hole, a sound I shall never forget. The monster stopped short and turned back toward its original route, along the road. Lower down, the David and Goliath battle between Lenson's group and 4 more tanks, all firing with all their guns, continued. We heard the final crash of Lenson's Panzerfaust. The tank closest to them turned back on its tracks, bumping the tank behind it. We could hear horrible screams through the demented confusion of smoke and flame. AT-34 drove straight over the hole which sheltered Lenson and his companion. Then it reversed, and leveled the place. So Lenson died, on the soil of Prussia, where he had wished to die. For us, the nightmare went on.